listening to KAGNLP 106.9 Salida, and this is Truth Quest with Melody, and I'm going to be bringing up my guest, John DiNardo, this evening. We've got probably a pretty full evening of some great guests this evening, but they are going to be varied subjects, because one of them is going to be speaking about Planet X. I know. This has been one for me. It's taken me a little while to embrace. And then we've got Clay Douglas. It'll be coming up after John DiNardo this evening at 10. And
hello.
Hello, John. I haven't had a chance to introduce you yet, so I'm going to let you kind of tell the audience about what you're about and your background. And we'll just go from there, because we've got the freedom to just go with it, go with the flow on your subject. So,
okay, I started out in the Marine Corps as an aircraft electronics technician. I really loved electronics, and there they gave me a very good Navy schooling on the principles of electronics and electricity and magnetism and related subjects. After leaving the Marine Corps, I went to college to become a high school science teaching position, a career in teaching. I gained a bachelor's degree in science education and specialized in physics, taught high school physics, and then went on to return back to the field of electronics, which I found was more challenging because it did not involve the repetition that comes with teaching 6 physics classes per day, the same subject, high school seniors. I saw that as a rather monotonous situation. Even though I love the field of physics, I knew that I needed something more creative and challenging. Well, anyway, my remainder of my career was in electronics with numerous electronics companies specializing in various electronics circuits and products and systems. And this gave me quite a bit of understanding of the principles of electricity and magnetism, which we find are now very important and key aspects of our solar system. And when the subject of Planet X arose, I became very interested. I felt inspired by God to see this as his plan for humankind, as a part of his judgment. And I know it doesn't sound very nice to most people, but we can understand more about it as we discuss this Planet X arrival into our solar system, its incursion every 36 and a half centuries, like clockwork. Well, anyway, that's a little background. If you would like me to, maybe I could start off by giving you some of the descriptions of past civilizations, people who survived the incursion of this what we now know to be a brown dwarf star. 36 and a half centuries ago, we have records of it. I can perhaps read to you from a book, one of the many books I have on this subject of Planet X.
Okay.
It's by Jason Rand. Go ahead. Sorry.
Yes. Now, and you've done several interviews with Jason. I've caught on other programs, and so, yeah, please do go ahead and read.
Well, this is right. This is a book by Jason Rand. That's R-A-N-D. The title is The Return of Planet X. And I'll just read you from starting on page 29. Atlantis, the lost continent, its very name conjures up mysterious and legendary visions of a civilization that long ago vanished beneath the ocean waves. Whether Atlantis existed or not is beyond the scope of this book. What has been recorded about the destruction of Atlantis, however, is important for us to briefly examine. Solon was a Greek historian, philosopher, and statesman who lived in Athens between 639 and 559 B.C. We'll say around 600 B.C., a little over 2,600 years ago, and was credited with being the wisest of the seven sages of ancient Greece. It is from the writings of Solon and his interactions with the ancient Egyptians that the first historical accounts of world cataclysms, including the destruction of Atlantis, comes to us through the ages. While on an extended stay in Egypt, Solon had many opportunities to study and learn from his priests, from the priests of Egypt. Ancient Egypt was a very advanced culture for its day, and history has documented many Greek scholars who traveled to Egypt in order to study in the temples of Egypt. On one such visit, the Egyptian priests conveyed to Solon the following story of the demise of Atlantis and the recurring cataclysm that caused it. Here's a quote from what the priest told to Solon. O Solon, Solon, you Greeks are but children. There is no old doctrine handed down among you by ancient traditions or any science which is ancient with age. And I will tell you the reason behind this. There have been and will be again many destructions of mankind out of many causes, the greatest having been brought about by earth, fire, and inundation, that's flooding. Whereas you, Greeks and other nations, did not keep imperishable records of Atlantis, we, the Egyptians, did. And then, after a long period of time, the usual inundation visits the earth like a pestilence and leaves only those of you who are destitute of letters and education. What he's saying here is that only a few people survive, and those people who survive are usually not historians. They're just common, ordinary people who happen to be fortunate enough to have survived. And thus, you have to begin over again as children and know nothing about what happened in ancient times, either among us or among yourselves, about Earth's history. Solon then went on, that's an end of quote from the priest that spoke to Solon. Now, Solon then went on to share with the Egyptian priests his knowledge of Greek history, including their account of the Great Flood. The Greeks had an account of the Great Flood, to which the Egyptians replied, "As for those genealogies of yours which you have related to us, they are no better than tales of children. For in the first place, you remember one deluge, one inundation only, whereas there were a number of them. And in the next place, there dwelt in your land, which you do not know, the fairest and noblest race of men that ever lived, of which you, the Greeks, are but a seed or remnant. And you did not know this because for many generations, the survivors of that last generation made no records." That's the end of the priest's quotations. Okay, now Jason Rand, author of this book, The Return of Planet X, goes on to say, in other words, what the ancient Egyptian priests were telling the Greek historian Solon was that many civilizations throughout the history of our planet have been wiped out by a recurring catastrophe. These civilization-ending cataclysms not only destroyed many ancient cultures, but their written records and recorded history as well, forcing them to literally start over again as children. This destruction of past civilizations and their recorded histories is one of the main reasons why our modern-day society has so little remembrance of these past global cataclysms. The Egyptians then went on to tell Solon about one such destroyed civilization called Atlantis, which at one time was a series of magnificent islands that sat in the Atlantic Ocean out beyond the Pillars of Hercules, that is, the Straits of Gibraltar. The priests said that the Atlanteans had become a rich and powerful civilization, and my comment is, parallels the United States Empire of today. Continuing, but their success had made them arrogant and warlike. And again, my comment is that parallels the United States Empire of today. The Atlanteans started to systematically invade the other cultures of the Mediterranean, And again, I have to interrupt and comment that this parallels the American / Israeli empire of today. And at one time, they had extended their advances to the very borders of Egypt itself. But then the usual inundation struck the earth, involving great earthquakes and floods. Does that sound like deja vu all over again to you?
You want to give a little bit of background on the author of this book while you're at it, John?
Well, Jason Rand, let me see if he has anything on his background here. Oh, I don't
know. What happened here?
The
there?
Person you have called at 97.
So we lost the call there. We may have to do some just amazing. It's so interesting trying to do this when you're doing this on your own. Even when you have help, it can be interesting. He may call back in and.
Hello, I guess we got cut off there.
Yes, that sounds like it. I hope this isn't going to be a reoccurring thing throughout the program, but in case it does, we can always use the phones, hopefully, so I'm okay.
Well, I don't seem to find anything on his background right here, but I can tell you that I've read other books on Planet X, and he has taken some passages out of other famous books by, Emmanuel Velikovsky and who else was it? Trying to think of the author. The book was The Greatest Story Never Told. Your listeners might remember, try to remember those titles and try to get those books. The Greatest Story Never Told. And John White, the author John White, wrote a book titled Pole Shift, about maybe 25, 30 years ago. So those are some of the books that I think he got his passages from, which is really good because, I mean, it's not really plagiarism. It's compilation of some great books. But I'd like to just continue here.
Okay,
but then
ahead.
After this empire got so powerful, and these are my own words, you know, just very much like our own American / Israeli British empire, world global empire, they got so arrogant, invading other countries, becoming rich and powerful. But then the usual inundation struck the earth, involving great earthquakes and floods. With little warning, Atlantis was engulfed by the ravages of the ocean, slipping beneath the waves, never to be seen or heard from again. The Egyptian priests, surprised by Solon's ignorance of the destruction of Atlantis, went on to say, quote, "This catastrophe must have escaped the notice of future generations because as a result of the devastation, for many generations, the survivors died with no power to express themselves in writing." These ancient Egyptian priests also related to Solon that the destruction of Atlantis took place violently and suddenly, as in a fortnight. The islands disappeared, they say. All disappeared due to earthquakes and floods in a grievous day and night. The accounts of Solon and the demise of Atlantis are not the only ancient records of massive cataclysms that the Egyptians have left us. In 1828, the Museum of Leiden in the Netherlands, that's Leyden, I believe, obtained a copy of an ancient text known as the Ipuwer Papyrus. That's Ipuwer Papyrus, Papyrus. This text, and papyrus is the kind of paper that the Egyptians wrote on, as you recall from your high school and college history. This text, this Ipuwer Papyrus, describes a massive cataclysm that struck Egypt thousands of years ago and sent this remarkably organized civilization into total disarray. Some excerpts from the Ipuwer Papyrus are as follows, quote, "Plague is throughout the land, blood is everywhere. The land turns round or over, as does a potter's wheel. Earth turned upside down, land upside down. Human beings thirst after water. What shall we do? All is ruin. Cattle are left to stray, and there is none to gather them together. Trees are destroyed. No fruits, no herbs are found. Grain has perished on every side. That has perished which yesterday was seen. The land is left to its weariness like the cutting of flax. Gates, columns, and wall are consumed by fire. The sky is in confusion. Incidentally, that means the stars were swirling around like a person, like a drunken man looking up and tottering off balance as he looks up at the sky. The sky is in confusion, and the fire ran along upon the ground. Incidentally, that's a quote about the fire running along upon the ground. That's exactly what you find in the Bible, in the book of Exodus, describing the great plagues that God brought against Egypt. Lower Egypt weeps. The towns are destroyed. Upper Egypt has become waste. All is ruined. The residence is overturned in a minute. H. Gardner, in his book, Admonition of an Egyptian Sage from a Hieratic Papyrus in Leiden. Well, that's a long title. A.H. Gardiner, G-A-R-D-I-N-E-R, states, quotes, "It is no merely local disturbance that is here described, but a great and overwhelming national disaster. What type of extreme geophysical event could have led to such a massively destructive situation? When this ancient manuscript says that the earth turned upside down and that the sky was in confusion, could it be referring to a time when the earth altered its rotation in space? Whatever geologic catastrophe the Ipuwer Papyrus is describing laid waste to an entire nation, destroying its cities, agriculture, and even its very infrastructure." Well, I guess that we can read on a little bit more later, but you see, these are my own words now. This is a recurring catastrophe, and it comes like clockwork, like a celestial clock, every 36 and a half centuries.
Okay, now, John, what made you start getting interested into this particular subject?
Well, I really believe it was inspiration from God. About back in 2002, there was a guy named Clay Douglas, who many of you have heard of. And
that's who I'm going to have him on after you're on tonight, actually. So.
Oh, he is?
Yes,
okay,
he is.
He's on your network. All right, great.
No, he's not on my network. He's going to be a guest tonight. So. After. Yeah, so.
Well, it was Clay Douglas who had the courage to present Mark Hazelwood, the first Planet X researcher, and probably the most famous Planet X researcher in our day, of our day. And Clay Douglas mentioned one day around 2002, he heralded the title of this book titled Planet Blindsided, Planet X Returns in 2003. Well, the first time I heard of that, Planet X, I immediately knew. I knew nothing about it, had never heard about it before in my life, and yet I immediately knew that it was true. And I feel that it must have been God giving me that inspiration to know that when I had no knowledge of that which I had no knowledge of. And I went on to study it and continued to pray to God as to what I should do or how I could bring this to people. And this led me to start a radio program to present the information in the form of a drama. And music in the background, very exciting, fascinating kind of information with me doing, very little talking and leaving the speech to many others, recorded segments from many others with music in the background. Well, that's how I got into it. It was basically a spiritual inspiration.
Okay. And so, I've kind of resisted this subject for quite a while because there was so much going on in the world at this point. But the timing at this point in time, I think, is pretty much apropos for events that are taking place around the world at this point in time, and I, you know, I try to open my mind up and look at these broader, the broader picture here, and even though it, I'm not, I never thought that it wasn't true, it's just there's so much going on that it, it was just another avenue. I'm going, oh, can I look at this?
Right. I mean, it was certainly, you were distracted by all the worldly events that are occurring, this new world order, this dictatorship that is racing to envelop the world. I understand that. And, you know, I'm very, very glad that you were inspired to talk about it, because people, there is hope involved here. Most of it is a great the major portion of the hope comes from God himself. He promises, for those who believe and for those who don't believe, even for those who don't believe actively in God and don't walk with him, they can be assured, from my testimony, and take it from there to find the evidence for themselves, they can be assured that God promises to save all who will call out to him for help.
Okay, now, let me take it a step further here, and this was crossing my mind when you were reading the passages from this book by Jason.
Jason Brandt.
Okay. And he, if you had possession of the history, and I'm just surmising this at this point. If you had possession of the history and you knew that these things came around like clockwork, and it has happened in the past, and you, being that there were priests that were in charge of this, possession of these libraries and the like, it could also be something that you could set up into the future as a means to control people, claiming that there's going to be these cataclysms of, you know, whatever means to you know,
to
set up their center.
Yeah. You use the fear of control, right?
Right. And that's why I'm noticing that they've been messing with these dates lately, because some of the writings that you're finding where, you know, they're predicting the, you know, these various events taking place are now, the dates seem to be moving around somewhat, and it makes me wonder if you know, that maybe they're having to move up, accelerate their, you know, this other events that could be around this.
Okay, well, let me try to answer that. I think this might provide more very strong foundational evidence to show that this planet is indeed approaching past Earth, on its way beyond Earth to its rendezvous with the sun, to loop around our sun as it has done every 36 and a half centuries. I'm reading now. I went to my county library and I photocopied, microfilm copy of the actual New York Times article of January 30th, 1983, New York Times, and I've got the actual photocopy of the article in front of me. Title is Clues. Now, this is the largest newspaper in the United States, and of course, we know they give us disinformation. They won't tell us very much about the New World Order because they're owned and operated by the men of power. But here, though, they're telling us something that actually they would not want us to know, but they let this leak out 27 years ago before the controllers of the mass media were able to realize how dangerous this information is. And that's what makes it so powerful, because it's something that the New York Times and the power elite would never want to reveal. The title, January 30th, New York Times, 1983, Clues Get Warm in the Search for Planet X, by John Noble Wilford. Quote, something out there beyond the farthest reaches of the known solar system seems to be tugging at Uranus and Neptune. Some gravitational force keeps perturbing the two giant planets, causing irregularities in their orbits. The force suggests a presence far away and unseen, a large object that may be the long-sought Planet X. Evidence assembled in recent years has led several groups of astronomers to renew the search for the 10th planet. they are devoting more time to visual observations with the 200-inch telescope at Mount Palomar in California. They are tracking two Pioneer spacecraft now approaching the orbit of distant Pluto to see if variations in their trajectories provide clues to the source of the mysterious force. And they are hoping that a satellite-borne telescope launched last week will detect heat signatures from the planet or whatever it is out there. The infrared astronomical satellite was boosted into a 560-mile high polar orbit Tuesday night from Vandenberg Air Force Base, California. It represents an $80 million venture by the United States, Britain, and the Netherlands. In the next 6 or 7 months, the telescope is expected to conduct a wide-ranging survey of nearly all the sky, detecting sources not of ordinary light, but of infrared radiation, which is visible to the human eye, which is invisible to the human eye and largely absorbed by the atmosphere. Scientists thus hope that the new telescope will chart thousands of infrared-emitting objects that have gone undetected, stars, interstellar clouds, asteroids, and with any luck, the object that pulls at Uranus and Neptune. The last time a serious search of the skies was made, it led to the discovery in 1930 of Pluto, the ninth planet. But the story begins more than a century before that, after the discovery of Uranus in 1781 by the English astronomer and musician William Herschel. Until then, the planetary system seemed to end with Saturn, as astronomers observed Uranus, noting irregularities in its orbital path. Many speculated that they were witnessing the gravitational pull of an unknown planet. So began the first planetary search based on astronomers' predictions, which ended in the 1840s with the discovery of Neptune, almost simultaneously by English, French, and German astronomers. But Neptune was not massive enough to account entirely for the orbital behavior of Uranus. Indeed, Neptune itself seemed to be affected by a still more remote planet. In the late 19th century, two American astronomers, William Pickering and Percival Lowell, predicted the size and approximate location of this trans-Neptunian body, which Lowell called Planet X. So here you see, over 110 years ago, Percival Lowell, the astronomer, gave it this mysterious body its name, Planet X. So it's not a science fiction, imagination. It is a real astronomical body. Years later, Pluto was detected by Clyde W. Tombaugh, working at Lowell's observatory in Arizona. Several astronomers, however, suspected it might not be the planet X of prediction. Subsequent observations proved them right. Pluto was too small to change the orbits of Uranus and Neptune. The combined mass of Pluto and its recently discovered satellite Charon is only one-fifth that of Earth's moon. Wow, that's very small. Recent calculations by the United States Naval Observatory have confirmed the orbital perturbation, that is the pulling of the outer planets, exhibited by Uranus and Neptune, which Dr. Thomas C. Van Flandern, an astronomer at the observatory, says could be explained by a, quote, single undiscovered planet, unquote. He and a colleague, Dr. Robert Harrington, calculate that the 10th planet should be 2 to 5 times more massive than Earth and have a highly elliptical orbit that takes it some 5 billion miles beyond that of Pluto, hardly next door, but still within the gravitational influence of the Sun. How do you like that?
Well, so
they're saying it's within the gravitational influence of the Sun, meaning the Sun could pull it in like a yo-yo. I'll continue reading. Some astronomers have reacted cautiously to 10th planet predictions. They remember the long, futile quest for the planet Vulcan inside the orbit of Mercury. Vulcan, it turned out, did not exist. They wonder why such a large object as a 10th planet escaped the exhaustive survey by Mr. Tombaugh, who is sure it is not in the two-thirds of the sky which he examined. But according to Dr. Ray T. Reynolds, I'm almost done. Please bear with me.
That's
the most important part of the article. But according to Dr. Ray T. Reynolds of the Ames Research Center in Mountain View, California, other astronomers, quote, are so sure of the 10th planet, they think there's nothing left but to name it, unquote. At a scientific meeting last summer, 10th planet partisans tended to prevail. Alternative explanations for the outer planet perturbations were offered. The something out there, that something out there, some scientists said, might be an unseen black hole or neutron star passing through the sun's vicinity. Defenders of the 10th planet theory parried the suggestions. Material falling into the gravitational field of a black hole, the remains of a very massive star after its complete gravitational collapse, should give off detectable X-rays, they noted. No X-rays have been detected. A neutron star, a less massive star that has collapsed to a highly dense state, should affect the courses of comets, they said, yet no such changes have been observed. Okay, we're almost done, and this is very important. More credence was given to the hypothesis that a, quote, brown dwarf star, unquote, accounts for the mysterious force. This is the informal name astronomers give to celestial bodies that were not massive enough for their thermonuclear furnaces to ignite. Perhaps, like the huge planet Jupiter, they just missed being self-illuminating stars. Most stars are paired, so it is not unreasonable to suggest that the sun, our sun, has a dim companion, another sun, far away. Moreover, a brown dwarf star in the neighborhood might not reflect enough light to be seen far away, said Dr. John Anderson of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California. This brown dwarf star, its gravitational forces, however, should produce energy detectable by the infrared astronomical satellite. Whatever the mysterious force, be it a brown dwarf star or a large planet, Dr. Anderson said he was quite optimistic that the infrared telescope might find it and that the Pioneer spacecraft could supply an estimate of the object's mass. And that's about the end of the article.
John, you've been you've really been out there being very diligent on trying to get this information out there and the subject being talked about. Has it opened up any doors for you to talk to any particular astronomers in out there in the community that may agree with this line of thinking?
I've never attempted to contact astronomers. It's too dangerous, I think, to try to talk to anybody who has any political or any scientific authority, because the government, as you know, they will kill people who seem to be effective in reaching and bringing unwanted truth, forbidden truth, to the public. And by me contacting these people, I could get them in danger of their lives and my own life.
Right.
But so I don't bother speaking to them. I speak to the grassroots public.
Okay. And you haven't run across anybody in the grassroots public that has been venturing out into bringing this up among the conversation, among these people. It would be within me to still ask. I couldn't hold it back. But, you know, I know that you've been very diligent at trying to get this subject down. So,
Most of the people that do talk to me about it are people like you, people who understand the New World Order, people who have spiritual discernment.
Okay, but like the 10th planet theory is well corroborated. And so, I mean, there's a lot of aspects to me that would say that it would be kind of like trying to talk about Judy Wood's theory among all the 9/11 people that don't agree with her, you know, her hypotheses of what may have, you know, been involved with.
Whose hypotheses? I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
Dr. Judy Wood's hypotheses.
Oh.
Okay. And so I don't know. I just find it interesting that, I mean, I see so many opportunities to at least skirt around the issue, even if you don't get into it heavy with any of these people out there. As far as, and I mean, because there's, I'm so uneducated in a lot of the aspects around this, but then there's so many things that I see that I have questions on. When you have, I mean, why did they? They're talking about a tenth planet. These guys back way back in history had it down, and to the point, how well are the calculations of the current astronomers or whoever who is saying it's, you know, it's here and it's now? I mean,
oh, okay. Well, what we have, let's go back a little bit. Now, what we're going to do is fast forward from January to show you what's happening, the evidence that's been presented in more recent years. We're going to fast forward from this January 30th, 1983 New York Times article, which heralded the launch of the infrared astronomical satellite, which was dedicated solely to finding this huge celestial body that could not be seen, but yet they knew it was there because of its mass. And we know they knew by Newton's law of universal law of gravitation that when a celestial body in orbit, such as the huge gas giants Uranus and Neptune in our solar system, are plucked out of their orbit, or what is called perturbed, out of their orbital paths, they know that only another gravitational force somewhere beyond those planets could actually cause those planets, Uranus and Neptune, to be perturbed in their orbits at one particular point in their orbital path. So they knew it existed because it was, so to speak, you could see the shadow of it. The shadow was its effect on the orbiting outer planets. Well, this astronomical satellite, following based upon those observations, indeed discovered Planet X, sighted Planet X during the year of 1983. And it returned, it did not return, but it returned its photographs. It's still in orbit, the infrared astronomical satellite IRAS. It returned its photographs to Earth, and by December, nearly the entire end of that particular year, 1983, the discovery of Planet X was heralded in the second largest newspaper in the United States. Not the New York Times, but the Washington Post, and I have the front page article from the Washington Post.
Right.
December 30th, 1983, exactly 11 months later.
And so they kind of
on the front page.
Okay.
Pardon me.
And so they kind of pulled this from, you know, from the public's viewing after that, right?
That's right. Exactly. Oh. And there's evidence now. As former President Richard Nixon once said, it's not the crime that incriminates them, it's the cover-up.
Right.
When you think of the Kennedy assassination, there's more evidence to incriminate these people based upon their clumsy cover-up than there is based upon the crime itself.
Well, let me ask you, now, a lot of the, I'm stating this correctly or not, I mean, are not a number of observatories under the possession or ownership of the Catholic Church?
There is one. Yes, I'll give you a quote from the famous Art Bell of Coast to Coast AM, who, you know, used to be the famous host of that program back in the 80s and 90s. And he, in fact, I even have the audio, and other people have it. You could probably find his audio track on the internet, where Art Bell interviews the high-level priest Malachy Martin, author of several books. This man has three doctorate degrees and was advisor to several popes. Malachy Martin was essentially releasing this information, blowing the whistle on it, and I believe that's what got him killed. He supposedly died from, you know, some kind of bludgeoning, or it was pretty well covered up. But what led to his death, I believe, and many people believe who study this subject, is he was beginning to speak about it, and he went on Art Bell, which is a pretty well-known program to many people who study these mysterious subjects. And Art Bell said to him, I'm going to ask you now, how did the Catholic Church, this gets to the answer of your question about the Catholic Church and their control of an observatory, how did the Catholic Church muscle their way, and I mean muscle their way, onto Mount Graham in Arizona and build this observatory? Why did they muscle their way into Mount Graham in Arizona and build this observatory? Why would a church get involved with such a thing? And Malachy Martin said, it is because the highest echelons of the Catholic Church know that within the next 5 to 10 years, something is approaching.
Okay.
He's answering the question about an observatory, mm-hmm. So that is quite explicitly stating that there is an ominous body approaching. And when you look at the Bible, which the Catholic Church supposedly espouses, you find the Bible does speak about the approach of celestial bodies. And there you go. So the Catholic Church is very much interested. And I got another story about the Catholic Church and their observations of this planet. But go ahead, ask your question, please.
Well, I mean, go ahead and do your observation first.
Okay. There's an Italian researcher named Cristoforo Barbato. He's a UFO magazine publisher. You know, the Italians are into ufology, and, you know, I'm not into it myself. But he was approached because of his interest and his ability to communicate the subject. He was approached by a man who claimed to be a member, an agent of the Italian Vatican Secret Service. He says this Secret Service is so cloaked that no one even knows, very few people even know of the existence of a Vatican Secret Service spy agency. And he called it the Servizio Informazioni del Vaticano, SIV. And this man approached Cristoforo Barbato, editor of the UFO magazine in Rome, and said, we've got a talk. And Barbato was very careful to check out his credentials that he presented, very careful, because he didn't want to be misled. Obviously, you can imagine how much disinformation he got from these people who were, well, if you were a UFO researcher, you would be very wary of disinformation from people who were a bit, you know, off base and incredible. So you'd have to check out their credentials very carefully, which is what Barbato claimed to have done. And he said after checking and seeing the man seemed to be very convincing, he met him on a secluded park bench in a Rome park. And this man told him that the Vatican was very concerned about this, and they have actually photographed this Planet X. This story probably must have taken place about maybe five or six years ago. He went on to say, the agent went on to tell Barbato that the Vatican launched a hypersonic aircraft from Vandenberg Air Force Base in California. Now, this aircraft was a camera, I guess small enough to be launched into orbit. Actually, not even into orbit, into outer space. It must have had a small propulsion system on it, and it was capable of transmitting its signals back in the form of a picture. And when it got far out, it would go beyond the outer bounds of our solar system and get a rather good view of this planet. And actually, you can see the footage that he claims is Planet X. It looks like a round object. It's very hard to tell whether it's phony or authentic, because you look at it and it looks like a red, huge red ball. And people say, well, that could be anything, you know. And I said the same thing. I had the same impression. That could be anything. But we have other evidence. And incidentally, if people want to see it, I think the website, it's an Italian website. And here's how, if anybody wants to write it down and take a look at it. It's called the Jesuit footage. It's A-N-G-E-L, like the word angel. A-N-G-E-L-I-S-M-A-R-I-T. itti.it.it, that stands for Italy, angelismarittt.it. Well, anyway, this photograph information was then received by radio telescope transmitted back to Earth at an abandoned oil refinery in Alaska, where they set up the U.S. government, evidently in collusion with the Vatican, set up a reception station to receive this radio signal of the photographed pictures of Planet X. So there's more evidence there. Now, beyond that, I can tell you about other sightings that made by the United States government.
Let me ask one thing before we go on. Okay, did Malachi Martin say anything about the timing of when the Vatican might have got into this?
Well, I believe it was 1990. Was it 1999? I'm pretty sure that's correct. When Malachi Martin was interviewed by Art Bell on Coast to Coast AM, and he said the Vatican believes it'll be in the next 5 to 10 years. So that could be as late as 2009.
No, I meant about them getting involved in the Mount Graham ownership or getting in there. Would he have stated when that took place?
That's not part of the interview, we could probably check out other information. I might be able to find it in my book by Mark Hazelwood. I don't think Mark would have stated the date when the Mount Graham was constructed.
Well, I just want to, and I don't know if this is even related or anything at all, but it just makes me wonder if that was right about the time that maybe when I don't know how long corporations have been involved in our NASA and being, I mean, because it's kind of like my understanding is somewhat privatized to a point. So I'm just wondering if the Vatican this would have tied in at any point, and I could be way off. Yeah, corporate involvement in the space program. And so once they went into being corporations, then the secrecy veil comes up. They, the government doesn't have to be as open about what's going on because it's now privatized. Do you see what I'm saying?
Well, I'll tell you, the government has never obey their obligation to the public to release this information, even when NASA may have been entirely government controlled. I don't think that ever was the case. Corporations have always controlled our government as far back as we can remember. But
there was an illusion there.
They've never been open to the public, government controlled or corporate controlled.
Okay,
they've always been secretive.
Right, but there's a lot of things that they left a veil there to make it appear that there was a difference and that they were obligated.
Their secretive policies are actually quite well known. They have a charter. In their charter, they state that no one working for NASA is allowed to speak out to the public. And all you ever get from NASA, very seldom does anybody get any information from NASA. And when you do, it's sanitized and silly and, it's mundane and not very informative.
Okay,
look at the moon rocks, the moon findings. They were just, there was not very much shown to the public on that. And we're not even allowed to authenticate those moon rocks. No one was allowed, I believe, to determine whether or not they were authentic.
I guess
so
the whole thing is
a fraud.
Right, and I guess I was kind of getting at the idea of plausible deniability, what they do when they separate out and state that this is a corporate venture, and so they're not obligated so much with the Freedom of Information Act. I don't know. I'm not an expert on it. I'm just posing that question, and it may be a little off topic of what this Planet X thing is, but my mind starts wandering when I start trying to connect dots.
So. Yeah, right. I'm trying to. I don't. Yeah, I'm trying to see what connection there might be there. But I think the main point is that our government has always operated in secret, whether it be through NASA or the military, industrial complex, or anything. Everything they do is secretive. The only thing I've gotten true from the government was when you go to time.gov and you want to know the time of day.
Okay, I mean, when the other aspect that comes in here is when they start covering up this Planet X thing, you know, what do they stand to gain by that? What there usually has to be
What do they stand to gain? Well, it's very important. You see, when the power elite, or like the Wizard of Oz, as long as they can keep the people in fear, they control them. Pay your taxes or else we'll come after you.
Okay, but they're not talking about the subject.
We'll come
I mean, they could keep us in fear talking about it or not talking about it. But
no, you see, here's the thing. When they do not want us to know about it. That's why they put clamped down a lid of silence on the subject after the discovery, which I'm going to read to you in a minute.
Okay.
At the end of 1983, when the infrared astronomical satellite had indeed found the location that they had calculated, and the object itself. They have a reason for keeping it secret, and this is because if the people were to know that something from God or something from supernatural power or something, even if you're an atheist, you could say something from the skies is coming at us, and it's much more ominous and fearful than anything that man's dictatorial government can impose on us. Well, then people are going to be afraid of this object coming from the skies. They're going to go into a state of panic. They will then change their spending habits and start preparing, buying things that will help them to survive, and stop spending money on luxuries and frills. Because the economy to collapse, the men in power, the men of money, the banksters who own and operate the governments of the world and are ensconced on the seat of power, those men will lose their fortunes because they can no longer control the people, they can no longer control your buying habits. And this is the reason why, and I'm saying I shouldn't be talking about this, but it doesn't matter. They know. I mean, the public maybe not know, the listening audience may not know, but power elite know that they will kill people for talking about this. I'm going to talk about it anyway.
Well, do you know of direct people that have died for talking about it?
Dr. Robert S. Harrington, the man, chief astronomer of the U.S. Naval Observatory in Washington, D.C.
Okay.
It was mentioned in this article here. Let's see. It says Dr. Robert S. Harrington calculated that the 10th planet should be 2 to 5 times more massive than Earth and have a highly elliptical orbit that takes it some 5 billion miles beyond that of Pluto. This is from the article I just read from the New York Times. Dr. Harrington, now we're fast-forwarding to give you more recent information as to the existence of this planet. That was in 1983. Throughout the decade of the 1980s, Dr. Harrington did extensive calculations as to the position that in the sky where we could see this, find this planet. And now it had been observed by the infrared astronomical satellite, had been pinpointed. Why would Harrington have to go through all of this calculations to find out where it's located? That's something that baffles me. The only conclusion I could come to is that NASA insisted on concealing this from Harrington because Harrington was not on the inside. Harrington wanted to reveal this to the public. So he was not given any data as to where they had located. So Harrington was left to fend for himself to try to find out where it was because the government was concealing their sightings data.
Well, there had to be other
satellite.
But there had to be other astronomers or whatever that agreed with him, or he wouldn't have made the New York Times or whatever. There had to be other people corroborating this, right?
Those men spoke about, they were at the launch of Planet X, the launch of the infrared astronomical satellite to look for Planet X in January. These were the men who were quoted in this article. at the launch. So had they made their statements prior to the launching, maybe they, I can only assume, and a lot of this is cloaked in secrecy, it's all cloaked in government secrecy, I can only assume that Harrington expected to get information and he must have been highly disappointed after the IRAS had made its sightings and the government refused to reveal this to Harrington. And we got a little bit of a few dots, some information to connect to that theory that the government shut the door on Harrington, the information door, when we see that, indeed, the public was no longer given any information, very little information on Planet X, after December 30th, 1983, when this Washington Post front-page article heralded the actual photographic discovery of it in this article. So Harrington was left to fend for himself to try to find more info. Harrington, of course, did that. He went on and did extensive computer calculations as to the position of this Planet X in the sky. And he wanted to determine, is it coming in? This is a big question. Is it incoming?
Okay, now let me just stop here just for a second and say this is KHEN LP 106.9 Salida. And my guest this evening is John DiNardo, and our subject this evening is Planet X. And one of the reasons, before we continue on with what John is talking about, is why I wanted to approach this subject is that when you have something the size of this object that could possibly be out there, would very probably affect the Earth and could cause plate tectonic movements or affect various other aspects that would affect humans, because something could cause earthquakes or volcanic activity or tsunamis, you name it. I mean, the moon affects the ocean, so it just started arising more questions as to, you know, maybe what you've been talking about is worth looking at.
Well, when you look at the sinking of Atlantis and read the historical records of land masses sinking beneath the sea very abruptly, other land masses coming up out of the sea, you realize that this is what would happen to on a microcosmic scale, looking at Earth from outer space and looking at imagining some force working at a distance, gravitational and electromagnetic, at a great distance away, pulling on the crust of Earth, just as the moon pulls on the tides. This is a good point that you brought up. The moon does indeed pull up on the Earth, on the oceans, and pulls the tides upward. Likewise, the moon has a gravitational influence on the Earth's crust. That's why there was great fear a few days ago about earthquakes occurring during this full moon, this super moon, when the moon got very close to Earth. And I have not checked the earthquake records, but who knows, maybe there probably were a lot more earthquakes. In fact, we know there was an earthquake very close to this in time, very close to the advent of this super moon. That was March 11th, just a few days ago, that caused the great earthquake that occurred in Japan that led to that huge tsunami. This earthquake was a 9.0 on the Richter scale, but of course, this brings up another point. The government lies about the magnitude rating, the Richter scale earthquake rating. They have falsified that scale to make earthquakes seem less powerful than they actually are. This had been done for at least 20 years now. So this is a huge earthquake.
And if they hadn't done that, then you have a confusion going on between the different scales out there too, because there's more than one scale. Which
that's right. That's right. They have the advanced. They have the modified Mercalli scale, which is really a joke. It's an insult to anybody's intelligence. And the reason they do it, these things, they falsify the Richter scale to make earthquakes seem less powerful. They devise this ridiculous modified Mercalli scale so that people will not be able to understand the magnitudes. They can really grossly falsify the magnitude readings of earthquakes. I think if you look at go to the USGS, U.S. Geological Survey's website, and find out what the modified Mercalli scale entails, what it means. It talks about earthquake magnitudes being gauged by the movement of furniture in your house. How much furniture slides on the floor. I mean, that's an insult to anybody's intelligence. How much shaking occurs in the walls? Well, how is the house built? What about earthquakes that occur where there's no houses in desolate areas? They still use the modified Mercalli scale. I mean, it's just infuriating to know how they insult us with these lies. But it's all coming home to roost because with all the falsification of the earthquake magnitudes, they still had to call it that Japan earthquake a 9.0. But people aren't even, people are impressed with that. But what they're really impressed with and scared by is the actual devastation that they see, that they saw in Japan and the tsunami, and the devastation that they saw in it with the Chilean earthquake back in January of 2010, and the Haiti earthquake, and the horrendous New Zealand earthquake that just occurred recently.
Okay, now, John, I've got a couple other questions here that my mind just starts going wild on this. But, okay, so if you've got a planet that could be affecting the Earth, it's got to be affecting other planets. I'm wondering if
it does. It is. There are the planet Neptune has actually gone through a pole shift. Neptune is much farther out, so it was one of the first celestial bodies to be seriously affected. In fact, we even read the article that ever since the early 1800s, now we're going back 200 years, astronomers, as long ago as 200 years ago, with their unsophisticated telescopic equipment, even then they noticed perturbations on the outer planets, pulling the planets right out of their orbit at a particular point in their orbital revolution around the sun. There's one evidence of what this celestial body can do because of its great mass. It has a gravitational pull. Just it acts like sort of like a celestial magnet.
So is it pulling us out?
Pardon me?
Is it pulling us out of our orbit
somehow? As it gets closer, it will. It definitely will. The Bible tells us, and science, ancient history tells us the same thing, that Earth actually rotated vertically when this thing got overhead. As it passes over our heads, over Earth's north pole, maybe about 20 million miles away from us, that's considered close, 20 million miles away, its dual force fields, gravitational force field and its electromagnetic force field, will, as it whips over the north pole, its south pole, the south magnetic pole of this planet X, this huge brown dwarf star, its south pole will lock up and attract Earth's north pole, because we know from science studies that the south pole of a magnet will be mutually attracted to the north pole. Opposite magnetic poles attract, just as opposite electrical charges attract. So as this huge body goes over, its south pole is pointing down toward the top of Earth, Earth's north pole, and it will grab onto it, lock onto it at a distance through space, invisible, like an invisible hand, and tilt, roll planet Earth just like you would roll a ball. And Earth will not. In fact, if you go back to... People in my house are sleeping. Hold on a second. Waking people up in the house here, but anyway, if you go to the Bible, Isaiah chapter 24, can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Okay. Isaiah chapter 24, verse 20 in the Bible. This was written 600 B.C., Isaiah says that God spoke to him, and told him what God would do, what he would do in the future, because the people, his people that he loved and created, that is people around the world, have forgotten him and gone against him. They have... Okay, hold on a second.
Okay.
And he says in Isaiah chapter... Maybe I should go to another phone. Do you have a break at one time?
Well, I can go ahead and do an announcement while I'm at it, so you can go ahead and do that, and that way you can go take care of what you need to take care of.
Okay. Can you call me back in about 2 minutes?
Yes, I can. Okay, just go ahead.
Even 1 minute or so.
Okay, just... I'll just close the call and then I'll call you back.
Okay, thank you.
Uh-huh.
Bye-bye.
Adjust a little bit on the recording levels too while we're at it, but I think we've got it okay. So, do you happen to remember where we were before we stopped? Or?
Okay, well, in the Bible says in Isaiah chapter 24, Isaiah claimed that God was speaking to him throughout the book of Isaiah. God would give him thoughts, not necessarily speaking outright to him, but giving him thoughts very clear in his mind that he was to write down, record for all generations of humankind to follow him, after him. In Isaiah, he claimed that God told him this, that God said, I will cause the earth to nod like a hammock. Now, this is the actual Hebrew explanation, Hebrew derivation of that particular verse, Isaiah chapter 24, verse 20. I will cause the earth, God says, to reel to and fro like a drunkard and to nod like a hammock. The King James translators got the word wrong. They called it, they said, it will be removed like a cottage. That's kind of confusing. So when I looked up the actual Hebrew words, removed and cottage, I found out that the actual Hebrew word says, God says, I will cause the earth to nod like a hammock. And if you take a model globe of the earth and place it in the bed of a hammock, pull the hammock back, you can visualize the North Pole would rotate from the top down vertically toward the equator, while the equator would rotate vertically toward the South Pole as you pull the hammock back with the globe in the bed of the hammock. If you swung the hammock, then actually you would see this globe nodding, and the word nod, I looked that word up in the dictionary. It means a vertical rotation, not a horizontal, but a vertical. So our Earth, what happens is when this huge celestial body passes over the top of Earth's North Pole, 20 million miles away or more, the South Pole, South Magnetic Pole of this planet X, this brown dwarf star, will lock up and be attracted to the North Pole, North Magnetic Pole of Earth. And thus, it will grab onto, at a distance, through space, grab onto the North Pole and rotate the North Pole of planet Earth vertically. And that is what's called a pole shift, where that North Pole, North to South Pole, is essentially close to the axis of rotation of the Earth. The Earth rotates around its poles, essentially. But now the polar axis would be shifted, tilted, and the entire Earth would tilt in its rotation. We see evidence of this geologically, this occurring. There are so many cases of incidents that prove this happened.
One of them that you spoke of Atlantis. Do you?
I'm sorry, your volume is very weak all of a sudden.
Is that any better?
Yes, that's
okay.
Better.
Okay, all right. Yeah, it's one of the problems when you switch from one thing to the other. But as far as Atlantis, how do you get into Lemuria at all?
Oh, you know, I'm sorry, I haven't. I've been meaning to study about that, and I haven't. But you know what? I can read some more. I think there's more of it in Jason Rand's book.
Okay.
If you'd like to hear it.
Well, because I would think that that is supposed to be in the area like where Japan is.
That's probably true.
And one of the things, and this is where it made me curious, again, to want to look into what you're talking about here a little bit more now, and I don't know if there's a relationship or not, but it just, that's just the way my mind works, and so you see the Chilean earthquake, then you see the New Zealand earthquake, then you see the, I think there may have been some Chinese, but I'm not sure, but there's Japanese.
Moving up toward the northern hemisphere. Is that what you're getting at?
Wow.
The quakes are moving up from the southern hemisphere.
Yeah. So you're wondering where they're headed next. But somebody was just here in the studio just brought up the earthquake map, and this, how current was this one?
This last 100 years.
Oh, the last 100. So the earthquakes pretty much just follow all the tectonic plates. Okay. Right. But it looks to me like it would be rotating around, and so there's a good potential that it might be working its way this direction. What do you think?
Yeah, I think it's correct to say that all the 12 tectonic plate sections that comprise the crust of the Earth will be, the greatest stress will be, or the greatest potential for movement would be at the edges of these plates.
Okay.
That is, like, visualize the Earth as a raw egg that's cracked in many places. And the most delicate, most movable portions would be where the cracks are. Those cracks must have occurred through past cataclysms. And if you visualize the Earth, just a little brief background, there are many physical objects today that we can compare to the Earth. I've often thought of it maybe as sort of structured like an avocado. That might be a good way to describe it. Or a raw egg is another way.
Now, would those gravitational things make the Earth kind of like grow and expand or contract too?
Yes, and again, here's another analogy that I've thought of after pondering this, trying to ponder very close analogies that we can visualize. We all can visualize. I like to teach in a visual way so that people can see in their mind's eye a concept, any concept. And I've thought of the way, I don't know if you've ever made pudding. If you haven't made pudding before, maybe a thick stew.
Uh-huh.
If you're cooking it in a big pot, look at the Earth, assuming you can't make it into a sphere, you can't turn your gas range into a sphere, but let's just take one cross-section of the Earth, say one portion, the northern hemisphere, for example. The gas flame below the pot would be analogous to the mostly molten iron core of the Earth, that liquid molten iron core. It's largely magnetic. And then above the gas flame would be the pot itself with the stew or pudding in it. Very thick mass. And that would be analogous to the mantle of the Earth, which is out further out from the center, from the molten iron core. And that mantle consists of rock that is so hot that it's turned to thick, very highly gooey liquid, it is the lava that you see erupting from volcanoes. And magma is simply lava that has not erupted yet, molten rock. Now that would be analogous to the stew, but if you turned off the gas or left the gas on, maybe let it cool a little bit, just as the Earth has cooled, there would form a skin on the surface of this pot of stew. The skin is more drier and more firm, and that is analogous to the crust of Earth, which is called the lithosphere. That crust is about 400 miles thick, deep. The magma, the molten rock beneath, below the crust, is about 1,400, I believe, 1,400 miles deep. So you've got a total of about 1,800 miles from the crust of the Earth all the way down to the beginning of the molten iron core. Well, this pudding, if it were magnetic pudding, you would be able to actually lift it up and down with it with a magnet. If you were to sprinkle magnetic particles in and mix into it, you'd be able to pull the entire mixture, the skin on top of the stew or the skin on top of the pudding, as well as the more viscous, more moist magma material underneath it. And that's exactly what happens to planet Earth when this magnetic pull and gravitational pull, both the magnetic force field and the gravitational force field, begin to pull on the surfaces of and in the depths of Earth. That's how we get land masses, thin crustal surfaces sinking below the oceans, and other areas at the seabed rising up out of the ocean to form islands and land masses.
So you, in one of the, some of your interviews recently, you kind of attribute what might be going on in the Gulf a little bit to whatever this approaching planet is, right?
Yes, it's very ominous, and I really have to caution anybody who lives in along the Gulf of Mexico to be prepared. I don't know how we can do it, but people have to get an early warning system to detect possibilities of tsunamis. I don't want to scare people. I just want to prepare people.
Well, whether you're prepared for war, or you're prepared for earthquakes or tsunamis or whatever. I mean, there's been certain religions that have been told you to be prepared for anything. And I mean, just if you have the water shut off, you know, or you floods or anything along that line, it's you prepare in much of the same manner initially, unless you're trying, you know, you really do want to get into some major specifics and like the fallout shelters that they had people building years ago.
We have to talk about preparation for survival. You know, the main preparation is turning to God in our everyday lives. And He is God, will be our Savior. He saved us spiritually from the penalties of violations of His law. His law is so perfect that none of us can fulfill that law. None of us can abide by it. So we just depend upon His great mercy and His self-sacrifice to protect us. And in the same way, He can protect us physically too.
Right, but we were given brains to at least figure out that we need to be prepared for any kind of disaster. And I understand where you're coming from, but you know, if those people over in Japan right now had some of that ability, I mean, there's certain things that they're not going to be able to be prepared for. But
no, I agree with you absolutely. We have to have both spiritual and physical preparation. So we walk with God in our mind and feel His presence as we go about our daily activities, and those daily activities have to be centered around preparation, physical preparation to withstand the floods that
and to be able to listen to others out there that are even talking about the possible events to come again, be these celestial bodies or the like, right?
Yes, I wish the people in Japan had a chance to know about this and to be prepared, and the people in Thailand and in Indonesia were inundated by the Christmas tsunami of 2004. We all remember that. Huge masses of water and debris coming in and
killing
people.
Okay, and is the government not training some of the military to be prepared for some major something that they're working around?
Yep. We have gotten very clear reports. Somebody alerted me to a Pentagon television program. It's actually a military television channel, and it's on. You can find it on YouTube, where officers of the U.S. Army are stating in a conference that they are having military drills in and around the New Madrid Fault Zone area in the lower Midwest United States. And the drills are supposedly taking place right around now, around this period of time. Also, and I just caught it on the Weather Channel a couple of days ago. I'm glad you brought it up. I've got to try to find the documentation on it. It's probably on the Weather Channel's website, weather.com. But they mentioned on the Weather Channel that also right here in New Jersey, not far from me, in northern New Jersey, in East Rutherford, they had FEMA drills, disaster drills. And that's what they talked about. The drill was in case of a disaster. Those were the words that were used in the Weather Channel's report. Likewise, in the report recently from the Pentagon, they said that these drills in the Midwest, around the New Madrid Fault Zone area, were for earthquake disaster. So it's very clear that they're expecting possible earthquakes.
Okay, but my understanding, too, is, though, that they've been building these, like, deep underground military bases or other facilities that they're moving the government away from the shoreline.
Yes, good point. John Moore had pointed out that the government, the CIA, has moved their headquarters from the East Coast around Langley, Virginia, out to around the Denver, Colorado area. Also, the Environmental Protection Agency has moved out from the East Coast to the Denver area. Also, the Vatican Library has been moved. That's a priceless library. The information that they have kept secret through the ages in the Vatican Library is priceless. So naturally, they would want to protect that. They have moved the Vatican Library inland to higher elevations. Also, Governor Jesse Ventura did a well-publicized, very revealing documentary on his True TV program, which, and I have videotaped that in high quality, actually put it on high quality DVD, his broadcast, where he went into, he and his producer, Michael Braverman, went to the Denver airport, and they found a great deal of evidence indicating that underground cities, underground facilities have been constructed. They saw these huge tunnel, concrete tunnel channels that were lying on the ground waiting to be embedded under the ground to form tunnel complexes. Michael Braverman went deep below the bowels of Cheyenne Mountain in Colorado and spoke with Colonel Wynn, the chief of security there. They have a highly trained military force that is trained to keep out intruders, to protect the facility, and Colonel Wynn stated just that, that these four troops that we have here are, their purpose, their mission is to protect this facility, even if it means killing Americans who try to come in during times of great peril, where they need to go underground to protect themselves. They said they have steel doors, many tons in weight, huge steel doors. Those doors will be closed, and he said you can knock all day, and no one is going to get in there.
Well, I certainly hope that they did a better job on preparing that than they did the Japanese on their nuclear plants and building them over faults. And those aren't the only ones built over faults where you would think that they would want to protect it just as stridently. Is what the term I want. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I mean, it's horrible what they've done. I mean, it's so outrageous and infuriating when you stop and think that they've constructed these potential nuclear bombs on top of earthquake fault lines.
Okay, now, but if I was building for earthquakes, I'm not sure I'd put it in the ground. That's where I'm having...
Well, I had the same confusion myself. I had the same
I could see it for
dilemma in my mind as to why would they do this. Well, I found out later on that underground geologists have found that there are relatively safe, very safe areas that, well, they consider very safe. If you're at the right depth and the right location, you can be safer from an earthquake than on perhaps on the surface of the earth. This is what I believe the geologists, I've heard anyway. And you can imagine that these people have the best scientific know-how money can buy in determining where to go to be protected. I'm sure they would be fearful of being crushed under the underground. However, God says they can hide themselves wherever they want. He's coming after them.
Okay, now would there be any kind
in the
of
Bible?
Okay, now would there be any kind of radiation that might be affected, or would that be something that this planet could affect in coming close that might set off these nuclear plants or set them up for failure, just like all these, four or five plants?
Well, the earthquakes is one mechanism causing earthquakes. That would certainly cause these plants to possibly be destroyed and go into meltdown. Another mechanism might be the strong magnetic field from this planet. And I'm glad you brought that up. Psychics, the whole field of psychic knowledge is a vast field of information that all converges on this prediction, prophecy, that this will occur, that this destruction will occur on Earth. And in the prophecy, this relates to the question you just asked about destruction of nuclear plants. One of the mechanisms, I believe, could definitely be the electromagnetic field of this planet being so strong that it could cause the nuclear facilities to self-destruct. There were some girls, young girls, in the town of Garabandal, Spain, G-A-R-A-B-A-N-D-E-L, Garabandal, Spain, back around 1964, about three or four girls. They were playing in the orchards, apple orchards, stealing apples, and it was a bright, sunny day. This is a recount, the story from the girls themselves. I've seen them testifying on tape. Of course, they're fully grown now and well into middle age. They were playing in the fields. It was bright and sunny. All of a sudden, they heard a loud boom. It sounded like thunder. And there was no rain or no reason for thunder at all with those clear skies. And one of the girls fell into a trance, fell on her knees and went into a trance. And then the other girls start to run for help. And they, too, fell on the ground in a trance. And they came back later on and told their parents, told the people of the town, that they had seen the angel. And these trances went on for a number of days, and the townspeople would follow them whenever they would go into this trances and be somehow influenced by this unseen angel. But there was one night that they called the Night of Screams. This was in a documentary, actually, called Ancient Prophecies, which was broadcast. Ancient Prophecies was broadcast in 1995 on ABC television, prime time on Sunday night at 9 o'clock. And in it, they recount how one night was called a Night of Screams, and a girl told the people of the town, "You cannot come with us for some reason." And the angel at that time told the girls something very horrifying. They began to scream. I guess they were seeing horrific visions that were given to them of what the future would be like. And when they recounted their vision to the people who recorded it, they said that it wasn't very clear, except they got certain things. One is that there will be a point in time when not a single electric motor anywhere on Earth will operate. And I immediately realized what that meant. That jibes with scientific theory, principles of electricity and magnetism. You see, when a magnetic field is strong enough, it can cause a motor to fail, because electric motors operate on the principle of electromagnetism. Magnetic fields are generated. Electromagnetic fields are generated in the wires, the wound coil wires of a electric motor, and those electromagnetic fields interact with a permanent magnetic field, and that's what causes the rotation of the motor, the interaction of two different magnetic fields, clashing, attracting, and repelling in a circular motion. Alternately, attracting and repelling. Well, when you have an overpowering external magnetic field, wiping out, flooding out, and saturating the magnetic field within a motor, then the motor stops operating. In fact, Guglielmo Marconi, the great Italian electromagnetic physicist, who was a colleague of the great genius Nikola Tesla, Marconi was able to demonstrate to Adolf Hitler during the early 30s, when Mussolini, the dictator of Italy, hosted Hitler in Naples, Italy. This is what I think Marconi, this Marconi's experiment was recorded in Tesla's book titled The Fantastic Inventions of Nikola Tesla. That he was Marconi was actually able to disable all of the electrical equipment motors in the German Nazi fleet that was docked in Naples Harbor, just to show how powerful the magnetic fields could be if you know how to generate one strong enough. And in fact, Nikola Tesla supposedly did that. He was able to incinerate a flock of sheep at a distance of about 12 miles away. This he has described in his book, The Fantastic Inventions of Nikola Tesla. Well, on a cosmic scale, you can imagine this brown dwarf star puts out a magnetic field that would make Tesla's and Marconi's magnetic fields seem like child's play. This thing is so huge that it would envelop the entire Earth. The magnetic field, invisible lines, would envelop Earth, just as the food inside the chamber of a microwave oven would be enveloped by this invisible magnetic field inside of a microwave oven, and that's how food is heated. The magnetic energy, magnetic lines of flux, penetrate the food and cause the water molecules to be highly excited and motivated. That's what causes the heating of the food.
So when you had a, if you had
an, what it would do to Earth, it would incinerate Earth.
So if you had an event that could be coming like that, and you knew that you couldn't save all the people, and you were trying to prepare for a way to not be, to survive it. I would find it almost mind-boggling to figure out, because it's going to be affecting all the planetary objects out away from the Earth, not just the Earth. And so they may have a problem no matter where they would try to hide or escape to. This thing is going to affect anywhere near. And is it dragging other things with it, I'm wondering?
Yes, it is. It's like a vacuum cleaner in space, because it is so large. It's defined as a brown dwarf star by Robert Harrington. Dr. Harrington, who was, we never got to his, what is likely his murder.
Oh, okay.
But we can get to that maybe shortly. But Dr. Harrington and others, even though Harrington stated in this New York Times article, he said it's 2 to 5 times more massive. I think I'm reading it here, 2 to 5 times more massive than Earth. That is a gross understatement. The only thing I know that Harrington must have known better than that, because Harrington says it's probably a brown dwarf star, and Harrington was one of the world's greatest astronomers and astrophysicists. He's calculated 2 to 5 times more massive than Earth. Well, It's more like 2,000 times more massive than Earth, not two times. You see, a brown dwarf star is defined as, you know, pretty wide range of masses can define a brown dwarf star. But the puniest brown dwarf star would be around 3 Jupiter masses. Now, one Jupiter has a mass of 318 Earth masses. So 3 times Jupiter, a puny brown star of 3 Jupiter masses would be nearly 1,000 Earth masses. Because of its great mass, we know from Sir Isaac Newton's universal law of gravitation that the gravitational force, the magnitude of the gravitational force of attraction between body A and body B is equal to the mass of body A multiplied by the mass of body B. So in space, you have this huge brown dwarf star, nearly at least 1,000, probably greater than 3 Jupiters, meaning at least 1,000 Earth masses. As it goes through space, its great mass is multiplied by the mass of the body passing, anybody's passing it, all that debris in space, comets, small planets, asteroids, meteors, rocks, dust, iron oxide dust, which is red in color. All of these particles will be gravitationally attracted to this huge gravitational magnet, so to speak, in space. And it would pull it along with it. And it even has little moons trailing it, like a string of pearls on a woman's neck as she would race through the wind. That's how these pearls or these moons trail behind this planet.
John, in doing this research that you've been doing on Planet X, do you have a number of colleagues that are working along with you or that you network with?
Well, one of them is Sheldon Day. He's helped out a lot. He's been very helpful in trying to publicize this information and publicize my information. And he also publicizes works of the people like this guy Lucas. I don't know his last name, but he talks about Planet X quite a bit. And, of course, Nancy Leader, she has some good information. I disagree with her whole concept of...
Was Marshall Masters one of them?
But she has some very good scientific knowledge as to what happens to the Earth and how it is affected by this passing planet. But there are many others, too.
And
Mark Hazelwood stopped talking about it, which troubles me quite a bit.
And now, is Marshall Masters involved in any of this?
Yes, I'm glad you mentioned that. Marshall Masters is one of the best researchers on Planet X. His website is youwusa.com.
Okay.
He's a former science editor for CNN, Cable News Network. And he's done a great job of revealing information about Planet X. One of the things he's brought out is there was somebody who leaked information. And I'm glad we're getting onto this because it reminds me of that some of the unanswered questions, the vast body of information. I didn't get a chance to go on to explain to you all the other information as we go chronologically closer in time to the present day. The scientific information from the government that's leaked out through their deception, despite their deception and suppression of this evidence. And that is, well, Dr. Harrington, we'll get back to him in a minute, but Marshall Masters brought out about the information about the South Pole Telescope, a multi-million dollar facility that was built in the harshest climate on Earth. Why would they build a telescope in an area where you can barely survive, where if you were, you couldn't even would live a few a minute in this harsh environment without being frozen to death? Yet they did. They undertook this great task of building this multi-million dollar facility only because this incoming planets coming down from below the solar system, below our ecliptic plane. The ecliptic plane is that imaginary disk in space, like that imaginary compact disk or record player that you might visualize, or it might be compared to a Lazy Susan table.
Now, one of the
that revolves. Well, on this disk, invisible disk, all the planets in the solar system revolve around the sun, but below this imaginary disk of planetary revolution, way, way down below, is coming this huge brown dwarf star coming up from sort of underneath the bottom of our table.
Okay, now Planet X, you refer to it as Planet X, but I thought it was like the 10th planet, so that would be the correct symbol for 10 if it was in Roman numerals, right?
So right. So, and also X, the unknown.
Okay, now is it also tie into maybe what Nibiru or whatever? Would that be another reference?
Nibiru.
To? Okay.
Nibiru is the ancient Sumerian name that the word which stands for planet of the crossing. And the reason they call it planet of the crossing is because the ancient Sumerians, and they say they lived about 4,000 years ago, but that doesn't quite agree with my calculations, because the Sumerians lived at the time of this great destruction. Now, it could have been the great flood of Noah's day. I don't know. I haven't studied history, that ancient history, that well. I guess Zechariah Sitchin, the late Zechariah Sitchin, is the authority on all that, and he says it was about 4,000 years ago, but that's just not right. It had to be, or the great flood of Noah's day had to be around 5300 B.C. Well, let's say the Sumerians lived during that time. They had ancient charts, and it's amazing to think that people we believe to be so primitive in those prehistoric days could have had such highly advanced technology. But they did, and there's evidence of it. I mean, many scholars have spoken about the findings where they had flying machines. They have records of highly advanced society that existed back then. And I don't know, I'm still confused as to the date, because this might have been around the sinking of Atlantis. You see, this planet comes in every 36 and a half centuries. So you would have had one passing around 1650 B.C., one incursion, devastating incursion into our solar system around 1650 B.C. That was at the time of the Israelites' exodus from Egypt, where there was great destruction recorded in the Bible and recorded in the Ipuwer Papyrus, which I just read to you. And then another 36 and a half centuries before that, remember, this thing comes in like a pendulum, like a cosmic pendulum that swings in, and it hits, as a pendulum reaches one extreme, and then it goes back to another extreme, and it swings back again, and the period of its swing can be precisely measured. It's a repetitive, predictable period. Well, just like this would be a cosmic pendulum that would come in every 36 and a half centuries. So 1650 B.C. was a previous incursion, where we see geological evidence of the explosion of the great Santorini volcanic caldera around 1650 B.C. That would have been provoked by the incoming gravitational fields of this huge comet, where all of our planets' volcanoes would erupt. So there's evidence right there. The great Santorini volcanic caldera explosion, estimated to have been the highest volcanic explosive index, VEI, in all of known history. Then you had the narrowing of tree rings that occurred 36 and a half centuries ago. Narrowing of tree rings would have occurred as a result of the darkening of the skies and the exclusion, the blockage of sunlight for vegetation. So we have geological evidence, we have biblical evidence saying that these plagues of Egypt occurred around that time, around 1650 BC, according to the Bible. Now, if you go back another pendulum swing, prior to 1650 BC, you land on around 5300 BC, at which point in time geologists Pittman and Ryan say that the Great Flood of Noah's Day occurred around 5300 BC. They have studied the Black Sea and found out from the studies of the Black Sea that this was around 5300 BC. And it all adds up. You do the arithmetic every 36 and a half centuries. We see these destructions.
Okay,
go back another 36 and a half centuries, and you have the sinking of Atlantis around 9000 BC.
Okay, so ultimately, if these gentlemen or the powers that be, whatever you want to call it, that may be preparing for, in possession of knowledge of these events in this planet, or they've been studying it and decided that, you know, the large portion of the population may not be able to survive it, so why tell them about it or exploit it to its most?
That's
because you would think that, you know, that they would, preparing to survive it would be what you would figure that, you know, they would want us to do, but then also then you're looking.
If they were good guys.
Right. But then again, if you maybe had a lot of,
if they were evil genocidists and they wanted to wipe out most of the human race, what would they do?
Well, it just might be a wonderful coincidence then, huh?
Yeah, I mean, it works out great for them. They get to exterminate most of us, use our money to build these trillion-dollar underground cities, and not even tell us about it.
And they'd build nuclear plants on earthquake fault lines, you know, so, you know. So.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder about that. I mean, you can't be that stupid to deliberately build nuclear facilities on earthquake fault lines.
Well,
maybe they figured, well, when the earthquakes come, that'll help to wipe out the humankind, the explosion of nuclear power plants.
Aren't we thinking of wonderful thoughts here? Ultimately with Planet X, and I know you wanted to get into a little bit on the preparation part, but I mean, I hear so many people talking about it, but it just kind of goes without saying. And either people, you know, prepare or they don't prepare. Because we have so many events going on. I mean, they shut down the electricity and that can kill your ability to get to water or, you know, heat. And there's all kinds of things that can take place.
Right. But if we prepare, though, we can, I mean, a lot of people, some people are just don't want to be prepared. They would rather just say, oh, I'll just die. You know, I've heard people say that.
Me too.
Isn't that crazy? They won't have the courage to commit suicide. Some people will live through it, and they won't have the courage to kill themselves. But yet they're the people who say, oh, don't even tell me about it. I just want to enjoy myself now. I'm going to live it up now, be as happy as I can now, and then when it happens, I'll just commit suicide.
Well, you can't even have them be honest about how much radiation's floating around the atmosphere now after all of that, those events, let alone, it'll be amazing how many casualties that'll come out of this event.
Right. I want people to be encouraged.
Mm-hmm.
God is so powerful and so wonderful. He guarantees throughout the Bible, and I've studied and prayed the Bible, prayed for understanding of it to God. This is what everybody should do, not just read the Bible, but feel the presence of God, even if they have to go stretch their imagination to feel that, to know that He's really with us, even though He's invisible. You can see His creation glaring all around us. Call out to Him as you read and realize that He guarantees throughout the Bible that He will protect supernaturally, by miraculously, protect anyone who calls out to Him for mercy. And when people are in fear, they will call out to God for mercy. So be assured that He's with you. And this is designed, this whole thing is God's purpose, I believe, is to make us, to bring us closer to Him, to force us to come closer to Him, because we know that without supernatural protection, we're doomed. So, I mean, it's very gloomy, but I have to give you the truth so that when the time comes, you'll be able to, or not even when the time comes, but starting from now, just walk with God in your mind, feel His presence, and gradually you'll feel a greater comfort, as I feel, a greater sense of comfort to know that He will protect me. But at the same time, as you recommend, we all should be prepared physically, because God did give us the intelligence to know what's happening, the discernment to know what will happen, just as He gave Joseph in the Bible the discernment to know that there would be 7 years of famine coming, 7 years of fat cows in the dream, in Pharaoh's dream, followed by 7 years of lean cows. And Joseph had that spiritual understanding from God that Pharaoh's dream meant that there would be 7 years of great abundance and 7 years of famine. So he prepared, was appointed number two man in all of Egypt under Pharaoh, and prepared the people. Likewise, we have to do the same thing.
Okay.
Start preparing, but also know that God will protect you and trust in Him. At first it's difficult, but after a while you'll get that comfort of knowing that He is indeed with us.
Okay, John, I want to thank you for coming on the program, and I'm sure that, you know, I will be continuing to explore this subject a little bit. I mean, to explore the subject, because, I mean, obviously that there may be more to this thing than being spoken about. And I'm certainly going to start digging into this a little bit more. And I hope we'll be doing this again. And I want to thank you.
Well, thank you. If I have one second to say that,
okay.
God came as our Savior 2,000 years ago, and He's coming again very soon to be our Savior once again.
Okay, and do you have a website, John?
Well, Sheldon Day has dedicated his website, a good portion of it. It's The Light of Day Radio Show, thelightofdayradioshow.com.
Okay.
And when you go there, just click on the big Planet X logo at the top, and that'll take you to a whole very voluminous Planet X page.
Okay, and we'll be speaking again here. Thanks a lot.
Thanks so much, Melody.
Mm-hmm. Bye.
Bye-bye.